Welcome to the 7th episode of Trust the Badge. In this episode, I interview Robert Burns, a special agent of the Department of Justice, an adjunct professor at Yale University, and a special agent of the Department of the Interior. We discuss how law enforcement is viewed in our current education system and how it can be improved in the future. Let's begin with an introduction from Mr. Burns.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Burns. I'm a retired supervisory special agent with the Department of the Interior. Currently working as an adjunct professor for a couple of different universities, a tutor on varsity tutors, and I also do legal research and legal writing for various law firms and associates. And when I'm not doing that, I do a little ghostwriting for thriller and sci-fi authors.
So thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And I'd like to start off with, what encouraged you to become a law enforcement official?
You know, it's not so much that it was encouraged. It was almost like it was just kind of like a calling. And I mean, you could say that it was kind of inspired by my father, you know, who I saw in uniform, in police uniform. And then, you know, when he was in his military uniform, so he was a criminal investigation division special agent. And when he wasn't doing that, he worked part-time for the local police department down there at Killeen, Texas. So he was working for the Killeen PD as a kind of like reserve officer, but it was a paid reserve officer. So my earliest memories of my dad is him in his uniform and, you know, me putting on his hat or, you know, trying to put his boots on or carrying his gun belt around. Without the gun, of course, but just the gun belt. And I think from just a very early age, like I just kind of knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I was already kind of drawn to protecting, as it will, you know, like, I didn't like bullies. I didn't like it if somebody picked on somebody else. And while that was rare, you know, growing up in the military, it still occurred. And, you know, I don't know, to me, it just felt right, you know, to protect, to be able to serve. I didn't have this desire to want to see myself succeed in terms of like monetary, you know, I didn't want to become rich. I didn't want to become famous. I just wanted to, I guess, kind of do what my dad was doing or do what my uncles were doing. And so when it's like, I didn't know anything else that I wanted to do. I just wanted to become a police officer as soon as I could. I kind of played with the idea of doing other things like joining the military, perhaps as an officer, maybe flying helicopters, but that was short lived. But I always came back to wanting to become a police officer.
So why specifically the Department of Justice?
Well, I started out with the Department of Justice, but one of the issues, you know, across the board, you know, in terms of law enforcement is every time you see a federal agent, you know, you think Department of Justice. And so that's what I started out in, because that's what I thought, you know, if you're going to be a special agent, you're going to want to work for the DOJ. But then once I was in, I realized that there were, you know, multitude of different areas. You know, these 1811s, which is the job series for a special agent in the government, you know, that we had criminal investigators, you know, for the Department of Interior all the way through, you know, the FDA. And I didn't realize, you know, even the post office had their 1811s, and, you know, Fish and Game had 1811s. And so I started out with the DOJ, and that was primarily because that's what everybody's heard of, you know, the Department of Justice. And, you know, that's where you want to get your toes wet, as it were. But once I was in, you know, I saw the light, as it were, and I realized that there was just a number of other areas I could go to. So I kind of floated over to the Department of Interior, and that was based almost to entirely on the fact, so I'm Native American, I'm enrolled in the Cherokee Nation, and the Department of Interior has the Bureau of Indian Affairs underneath it. And so I was just naturally drawn to that, because that serves my people, but it also serves the people of the United States at the same time. So for me it was a win-win.
How long have you been a special agent?
Started in law enforcement, though, when I was in 1996, so that was uniformed. When I got out of the military, so I was active duty from 2002 to 2008, 2009. So it was about 2009 upward to 2016. And then I took a break for law school. And to be honest, I thought I retired. I thought I was going to retire from law enforcement, and then I was going to become a lawyer. And that's what I was going to be doing from that point on. But the pandemic had other plans for me, so which hit about my fourth year in law school, and it unfortunately it ended some of the prospects that I had as those law firms, were shuttered, some of them permanently. So I went back into law enforcement as a supervisory special agent, and I stayed there again for another, a few years, I think three years. And then I finally, my wife jokes about it that, I retired a second time. She's not buying it. So she's kind of like, oh, I guess we're just taking a second hiatus. Maybe we'll head back in. Who knows? But as of right now, I retired about a couple of months ago from becoming a, from being a special agent. So it's been all, I don't want to do the math, but it's been a few years. I don't want to do the math because that makes me feel old. But it's been a few years.
Wow, that's a lot of experience. So in your various aspects in law enforcement, what were your different duties as an agent?
If you're working as an 1811 or a 0083, those are job series in the federal government for police officer and for criminal investigator. And it's not uncommon for those two areas to kind of bleed over each other. So as 1811 for certain agencies, you may find yourself in uniform, and as 0083, which is a police officer, you may find yourself in a suit and tie conducting, what would be normally be the duties of a criminal investigator. So the normal duties of a criminal investigator, just the day-to-day, is you're typically conducting felony investigations, and you're doing a lot of follow-up. So whatever the law enforcement side, the uniform side has uncovered, or suspects, they've maybe conducted a field interview of somebody that was, say, maybe tied in with a cartel or a organized street gang, and they pass the information on to you that leads to, say, some in another investigation that you've heard about or that's been passed down the line. Your job is to, to conduct primarily felony investigations, and you're going to work a lot with the what we call the AUSA, the Assistant U.S. Attorney's Office, and you're going to do a lot of working with a lot of different agencies, local, state, and other federal agencies. And in my role, my last role, I worked a great deal with other federal agencies, a little bit with the state, and then when it came to local, I worked a lot with like the tribal agencies first. And then I worked with like local agencies that say either assisted tribes or say were contracted to, perform law enforcement functions on tribal property. And so that's not completely, across the board, for all 1811s. That's not something every 1811 does, but something specifically that I did. And but primarily, if I had to narrow it all the way down, 1811 is going to be conducting their criminal investigations, their primary felonies, and but each agency, each department has like their own little specialty, hence special agent. So just generally criminal investigations. And then for my agency specifically, it was, it was serving the tribal, the nations, communities and those areas around the tribe, nation, and reservations.
Just so everyone knows, could you just explain what an 1811 agent is?
Yes. An 1811 is a job series. So it's the OPM, Office of Personnel Management's job series for a criminal investigator. And it's kind of like your ultimate goal. When you work in law enforcement or you're working as an investigator, you want to be an 1811. 1811s have top secret clearance. They conduct the undercover operations. They do like the drug interdiction and counter gang and counter cartel, and it's FBI agents, 1811, Secret Service 1811s. These are all encompassing job series for criminal investigators versus a 0083, which is a uniformed police officer, uniformed federal law enforcement officer. And as I told you before, they kind of bleed over each other. So depending on the agency and department, you may find yourself as a uniformed police officer doing, the work of an 1811. As an 1811, you may find yourself doing the work as a police officer in uniform. So it just depends on the agency.
What was your favorite part of the job?
I think my favorite part of the job, I worked really hard to bridge the gap between law enforcement and the community. And It's not something that occurs overnight. It's certainly not something that occurs even in a month or two or even a year. But eventually, the work that you put into bridging that gap between, say, community and law enforcement, it does come in. If you're working pretty earnestly at it, within a year or so, within a couple of years. And then my favorite part of the job was seeing, the community look forward to seeing their police officers or supporting their police officers and the police officers supporting their community. And when you see that kind of a relationship, flourish or, come into itself, to me, that was my favorite part of the job. I know other people look for things like, oh, my favorite part was, conducting warrants or doing traffic stops. But for me, it was watching a community come together. And I knew that once that occurred, we could actually be effective as law enforcement officers and as the community. We can actually finally be effective at making our community safe once that occurred. So I really enjoyed that part of the job.
What would you say is your least favorite part of the job?
I think a lot of people probably agree with this. Anybody that's been, in law enforcement for any amount of time, especially if you've been in, a town or a city that's got a large population, you're going to get a lot of these calls. But generally, anything involving young children. In one aspect, I'm glad that I was there to help or to protect, to provide some sort of service. And on the other side, it's these are the things that'll, if there's anything that's going to haunt you, it's going to be calls for service that involve children. And, I could honestly say that, like I would gladly give any number of days if I didn't have to go to any one of those calls. They do happen. And, when they do happen, they're never really that good. And, these are the kind of calls that kind of stay with you the longest, if not forever. And it's not something that they talk about in the academies. It's not something they talk about during your field training, but it's something that definitely needs to be addressed at some point in your career before you begin your career as a police officer, is that you're going to come across some things involving children that are going to really be upsetting. That's the worst word I could possibly use, upsetting. I wish I had something a little bit stronger, but it's going to be disturbing. And I would say that was the my least favorite part of working in law enforcement.
I understand. But going back to your favorite part of the job, how often did you communicate with the public and the community?
So I was notorious for this. I all the time. So, if I wasn't doing an investigation, I was probably going to be out in the community someplace, and not just doing traffic stops or, something like that, or consensual encounters, or I would just get out of the vehicle and I would just, walk around the community, see what's going on in terms of, like, if there was like an event. I would be very careful not to interject myself. If there was like a block party or something, I just wouldn't show up and just kind of push my way in. I would prefer to have been invited. And so if I see something like that occur, I typically, don't just walk up to it. But other events, like, people at the park or whatever, I come out and just kind of say hi. It's something that has to happen like every day. It's not something you can do like once a week and expect it to be effective. So I would do this quite often. After a little while, you start getting invited to events, and one of the big deals is getting, invited to a powwow. When you're working on the tribal lands, that's a big deal, because powwows are considered, it's not something that we typically just invite everybody to, although some could be open to tourists. There are aspects of the powwow that are sacred, so getting invited to it is like, it's like an ultimate invitation, and that you've started to finally arrive at bridging or healing those wounds between the community and, say, government or the community and law enforcement.
That's actually great that you got to connect with the community more. Depending on the community and the type of people in it, how do you manage with the people that are against you simply because you are law enforcement?
I mean, that's going to happen quite a bit. The larger the city, the more you're probably going to come into contact with that. And I respect their opinion. They have a reason for it, whether they've encountered it or heard about it or whatever the case may be, there's a reason why they feel that way. And what I don't do is try to pressure, that's one of those areas where you don't pressure yourself into it. You don't force it, as it were. But you try to take the opportunities you can, reaching out to them, letting them know that, hey, look, I'd love to be able to speak with one or two of these community leaders to see what we can do in terms of being able to heal this relationship. And letting them know too that, that's the best part about living in America. You're allowed to have a completely opposite opinion of me without any sort of punishment or reprieve. And but this is one of those jobs that the more in tune with the community I am, then the more effective I can be as a police officer or as a special agent. And also, the safer their communities can be, if we've worked out a relationship in terms of like communication, after a little while, they can start communicating with like, yeah, we do have a drug problem, or we have a theft problem, or they start looking out for each other as well. And then they communicate that with you that so-and-so's house, I think, they're away on vacation, or they're away, doing something, and somebody's in their home. Where, before they may never have contacted you for that, maybe even tried to handle it themselves or not done anything at all. And, if you've worked with the community, if you've been, trying to, heal that relationship, they may end up calling you, and, you may end up like, catching a burglar in progress, or at least helping those people, because, they may think that, everybody's just kind of out for their own, and now somebody's burglarizing their house and nobody helps them. And, they may think that they have to take drastic steps that they don't even know are maybe unlawful, or, it goes a long way in terms of like just respecting their opinion and honoring that they can have that different opinion without pressuring yourself into their viewpoint.
Going back to how you were in law enforcement, what encouraged you to become a professor at Yale?
So with Yale, I'm like a exterior adjunct, invite right now. I'm working my way in. It's very difficult to become a professor, and it does take a long time. And it's something that I don't think you'll ever reach a top professorhood, as it were. You're always just kind of like learning and networking and reaching out. So Yale was an easy one because my wife went to Yale as an undergraduate. She was a pre-med student, and I had the opportunity to meet with a few of their professors and fellows and students at various occasions, like at various Yale clubs in the Connecticut area, New Haven and Hartford. And they've always had a great reputation for constitutional like studies. So for me, it was a natural to try to, try to get in there and meet with them or talk with them any way I can, or and work out any way that I could assist, like say with tutoring, or with even teaching a class, or just helping students like understand the material. And that's about where I am right now, as I work my way into, what I would like to do is a full-time tenured professor there at Yale in their law school. I think that'd be fantastic. But it's a process, it's like anything, you've got to work at it. And so right now I help students just kind of understand the material, and it could be really anything, but it was based primarily because of Yale's background, Yale's history. You also the fact that, my wife is a Yalee. She's an alumna there. And it's just a I don't know if anybody's ever seen Yale's campus or their law school, but it's also a pretty beautiful place to hang out at. But it was their reputation is what really kind of drew me to them.
Be specific, what course do you teach at Yale?
So it varies. Like I said, so I kind of like fill the gap in terms of like what the students maybe need a little help in, or if they've got a particular question about something. So, but primarily, I try to focus in on constitutional law, con law. And but I find myself actually addressing a lot of contracts right now in business association, business organization, and contract law, which is fine. I love it. I think those are great. You can't go wrong when you're in law school and you see all these subjects pop up and you think, hey, maybe I'm gonna have a specialty or something. That really isn't the case. Like even if you're gonna be like a, you say a public defender, You're gonna do criminal defense. Knowing and understanding things like, say, property contracts and torts, all that stuff is gonna come into play in, being a public defender. And if you're a contracts attorney, everything, like constitutional law, torts and things, all it's gonna come into play as a, a contracts attorney. So you're kind of helping out across the, if you're doing one subject, you're actually helping them out across the board, as it were. So what I want to do is teach constitutional law. And what I'm doing right now is more like contracts and business association and business organization.
When you were in law school or even in college in general, how was law enforcement viewed in your classes then compared to now?
One of the things that when I got into law school, there's a big difference between a 1L and a 4L. And so some law schools do 4 years, some law schools do three. My law school does like 3.5, depending on what electives you're taking. And typically because we've got additional like research and legal writing that's attached to ours. And also I was a double degree, so I was getting my master's and my doctorate at the same time. So I had to take a few extra courses. And from the first year, you get a various, varied students from my law school drew them in primarily from the West Coast and, kind of like on the East Coast universities. That's where most of the students came from. And they all had a pretty negative viewpoint of law enforcement. And, from day one, I'd say all the way through the first semester, their idea of law enforcement were, these guys are bullies, maybe you were bullied in high school, now you're trying to take revenge on people that, that they picked on you, and now it's your opportunity to pick on them, and you're power hungry, you like violence. And they had all these really bad misconceptions of what a police officer is, and a whole lot of judgment, a lot of prejudice going on. And the by the time they got to their second year, it evolved. So it stopped being those people, and it started becoming, like our officers, our police. And they started to see more like that. So the more internships they started to do, the more we got into our courses, the less judgmental they became of law enforcement officers and the more supportive. And by the time they got to their final year, they had matured enough that it was, they understood that, yeah, there's bad apples. There's bad apples in just about every profession. They stand out more in law enforcement because I think they're rarer. So they do have a tendency to stand out. If it was commonplace, it wouldn't be something that was newsworthy. But they understood that, okay, that was one incident for this one area during this one officer's day. Maybe they have a history of it, who knows? But they stopped prejudging. And they started taking the incidents one case at a time. And they were more pro law enforcement by the end of law school than they were when they started. And you can't help but do that. I was really pro law enforcement when I started. And by the time I got to my second or third year, I was much more middle of the road. I was much more unbiased. I already had an understanding that it was, that individual officer, that individual, task during that portion of that officer shift, it could have been an anomaly. Maybe it was habit, who knows? But I began to be more neutral as well. So I was able to look at cases with greater detail. And I wish I had many of these cases. I wish I had a law degree before I was a police officer, because it definitely would have helped me out in my career as a police officer at like 1,000%. It definitely made a big difference in what I did and how I did it. But from the beginning of law school to the end of law school, we went from like definitely against law enforcement. By the time they got to the center, they were pretty pro. By the time they got to the end, they had a very mature viewpoint of law enforcement, very supportive. So it was strange to see, like, as an undergraduate, at least for their universities, how anti-police they were. And maybe they didn't start out that way. Some of them shared their story, some didn't. But for those that shared their stories, they started out pretty neutral or having a favorable viewpoint of police. They went into their university, they left negative viewpoint of police, even if they never had contact with law enforcement. And then once they got into law school, they matured and they were exposed to police. They were exposed to the law enforcement side of the house, the DA's office. And so it was like the more education they got, the better their viewpoint of law enforcement became, but also the more mature their viewpoint became.
As you experienced law enforcement being the low-hanging fruit of the education system, usually it's attacked when teaching the Constitution. As a professor who teaches the U.S. Constitution, how do you approach teaching your students about law enforcement?
So if I'm teaching in terms of like law school or say students that are like in their graduate courses, is it's a little different than how I teach like say high school, or if I teach like undergraduates that are not in a like a law enforcement program or a law program like pre-law. If we're talking about law enforcement and we're talking about the Constitution, typically I take a very neutral road, so I think maybe I try to address any issues in terms of like their questions. Like, so one of the first things I do is I start to gather up the information by generally asking them their viewpoints of law enforcement. What are some of the prejudices that are out there? And I try to let them know too that when we're talking about prejudices, we're just talking about prejudging something. So, we're what is our current opinion of something, even though we've never encountered it, but it's something that, we may feel like in our small community or our small universes as it is around us, is like what is our general viewpoint of something? So even, that could be something, we may prejudge the way a banana tastes from a certain area, or we may prejudge certain types of food. So in this case, what are their prejudices against like law enforcement? And then we kind of address them. And it's not so much that it's tied to the US Constitution course as it is just kind of addressed to law in general, specifically when we're talking about like criminal law. So in law school, if we're going to do law school, those are separate. Constitutional law is not covered, by just specifically law enforcement officers. They're just government actors, just the government. But we have to talk about criminal procedure. So criminal procedure is a separate course altogether, which does talk about specifically law enforcement officers, the judicial system as it deals with the crime, criminal courts, and corrections. So those are two separate issues. So if we were to take the question you have and split it between constitution and con law and then say criminal procedure, in the criminal procedure course, when we do talk about law enforcement specifically, once again, we do talk about those prejudices, but we also talk about the type of training, because we have to talk about the tiers of the judicial system. And the first tier right there, between, the courts and the people are the police officers. And, one of the things that a lot of people don't know or don't understand, or at least when I teach it here on the East Coast, the law enforcement requirements are very different than, say, in California. And then if you're in the middle of America, like in Missouri or Oklahoma, the law enforcement standards are much different than, say, the East Coast or, California. So the first thing we talk about is like what's required of law enforcement, in meaning that, what's required for that candidate that comes in, he signs up, he puts his application in, and then the testing process to become a police officer recruit. And then what do they cover when they're in the academy? And then not only in the academy, but what do they cover when they're in the field training program, if their agency even has such a thing as a field training program? And then what the officer is going to encounter and how they're going to learn, that learning process, that learning curve, if you will, from being on the street and being partially supervised by, say, a senior officer, maybe a sergeant, to, finally becoming a solo beat officer or, a corporal or a sergeant themselves. So when we talk about that process, generally there's, they get a better viewpoint of what it is. Okay, law enforcement officers are not, born with this innate ability to understand the Constitution. They're also not provided a super detailed account of the Constitution. They're provided certain aspects as it pertains to, say, their state law, but they may not understand all the nuances. And in some cases, they may even be provided old information about, say, intent being criminal intent and then what it is that amounts to criminal intent. So they may be provided like old information that, you know, maybe the academy didn't update it, or their state post agency didn't update the information. So the instructors are providing, you know, information that may be, you know, two or three cycles old. So that officer may be leaving the academy even with, you know, incorrect information. So that was eye-opening for a lot of the students in my courses in the criminal procedure, because that, you know, they believed that, you know, when law enforcement officers leave the academy, when they leave their training, that they're experts in constitutional law. And they're, you know, some of them are surprised to find out that that's not the case. Now, we're talking about the difference, though, in definition between expert, right? So expert is really nothing more than somebody who has like a little bit more detailed information about a certain subject than the average person. And in this case, they were defining expert as somebody who, you know, can take a scenario and expertly, you know, dissect it, compare it and analyze against the Constitution and come up with a conclusion, you know, as they're going through, you know, the scenario itself or through the contact. And when they found out that that's not the case, you know, it was eye-opening for some. And then the amount of training and how quick they're trained, and then, you know, what we expect of them as a community, you know, it's very movie based, very TV based, you know, book based. It's not really based in reality. So a lot of what I was doing was just kind of bursting Hollywood's bubble. Same thing, you know, when we educate people on what we do in special operations or what we did in the military, you know, they have a different mindset altogether, different expectation. And then when reality comes in, it's like, oh, well, that's not what I thought it was going to be at all. So we, you know, a lot of it is just this dispelling myths, rumors, and, you know, prejudices, and then providing factual information, you know, from an unbiased view, because naturally I want to be biased because of my time in law enforcement and my pride in my service. But I make sure that it's unbiased because I want them to have the information, but I want them to come up to their own conclusion. I want them to have their own opinion on the subject.
What if you were not in law enforcement? Would your opinion be different in terms of teaching topics such as the Fourth Amendment?
If I wasn't a law enforcement, I think teaching in terms of the Fourth Amendment, it would be different. It would have to be different because I wouldn't have any practical like experience in it. And there's a big difference between somebody who has read about it and is now going to teach you versus somebody who's done it, has read about it, and now is going to teach you. So absolutely, yeah, there would be a big difference between me teaching if I was just reading or me teaching the Fourth Amendment based on my experience, my education. You know, I think that it provides a completely different, or not a completely different, it provides an additional layer to the cake, as it were.
How do we change the current education system to be unbiased towards law enforcement?
It really kind of starts with the law enforcement itself. And that's difficult because right now, a lot of the agencies across the U.S., you know, because they talked about, you know, defunding law enforcement, but many of the agencies across the U.S. are already underfunded. They can't be more defunded, you know, they're barely scraping by as it is. And they're, you know, in some cases, they're suburbs of larger cities or suburbs of larger counties. And so they're very busy. So it's very difficult to have one of those guys break away and get to the community to be able to do this. But it really starts with, by do this, I mean training the officer. And you're training the officer not so he understands where he's at, but so he has the language that, you know, he can help with, say, spreading that to the community. Now, it's very much like a teacher-student relationship. You know, the teacher being the police officer, the student being the community. You know, you can't expect the community to alter their way to figure out what the officer knows. The officer has the information. They've got to try to figure out their way to alter it, and, you know, not alter the information, but alter their teaching to fit the community. So, because not all, you know, they don't all learn the same. You know, you just can't get out there and just push a bunch of flyers out and, you know, hope that somebody picks one up and educates themselves. You know, you've got to alter your approach. But it really starts with a police officer making sure that he or she has a pretty good understanding of not only their role, but their law enforcement role in the law, and then getting them to educate the community and what that role is. And there's nothing we could do about the national media. There's nothing we could do about rumors or social media spreading misinformation. You know, that's a very big pie, you know, and honestly, it would take, it's just, you would dedicate so much resource to it and energy. I mean, you would never see your community again if that's the direction you were trying to go. It really kind of starts with that one police officer and that one person, but the officer having the training, the desire, and the knowledge, you know, to be able to pass on correct information, unbiased information about law enforcement, educating the community about what we can and cannot do, some of the limitations, you know, some of the misunderstandings that occur from the media in terms of like use of force, which are generally what the media, you know, grasps onto is use of force scenarios. And that's, if we could get that part solved, you know, I think we would do or go a long ways into dispelling the myths and rumors of like, you know, and also the kind of unfounded hatred or unfounded dislike for law enforcement.
In your opinion, how does the public and media misunderstand policing, and what specific scenarios would you say would put law enforcement at a downside when the media is projecting them?
I think it all comes down to that Hollywood myth, you know, that TV myth of it's fictional, you know, that these law enforcement officers are somehow superhuman, that they have abilities that the rest of the community doesn't have. They damage it a lot by they omit information, really is what they're doing, especially the media. The media has the ability, they're trained. The journalists are trained to investigate. Some of them are fantastic investigators, and much of the information that they would need is actually readily available on the internet or, you know, a phone call away. Instead, they omit some parts of the information, and, you know, and the community, you know, and people seem to understand it. At least they say they understand it, but I don't think they truly understand it. Is, you know, the media, the news is business. It's still a business, and it's always been a business. And this complaint isn't new. You know, you can find, you know, what I'm about to say on the record, you know, in the 1700s and 1600s in England and here in the US, where, you know, the media is being biased or the media is not sharing all the information. And that's because they want you to buy their paper. They want you to click on this link, you know. So by omitting certain pieces of information, technically, at least according to them, that, you know, they're not lying. Criminally, they're not lying, you know, but, you know, it harms law enforcement. So, and then they like to use general terms, general words like law enforcement, you know, police officers, instead of using the what it really is it's, you know, it's not law enforcement, it's not police officers, it's Officer Joe Schmo. It's Officer Joe Schmo was on this traffic stop on this day, you know, when this occurred. It is not law enforcement was conducting traffic stops, you know, across the US, and, you know, these very general statements. And unfortunately, you know, the community, especially now, so modernly, and this ebbs and flows, you know, through time, depending on what's happening socially. But right now, of course, you know, we've got the pandemic, and, you know, we're not coming off the pandemic. It's still there. It's still bad. But mentally, people are fried, you know, and they're fried from what we call information overload. And then, of course, they're, you know, we separated them from their loved ones in the beginning, and it was like not a lot of information was coming out. We didn't know. So there was like this lack of control, and so that borders on, you know, having even PTSD. You know, here we have this dangerous thing that, you know, could potentially kill you, where we don't have much in it, you know, we have no idea what's going on. And then, you know, here, wear a mask, don't wear a mask, wear a mask, don't wear a mask. You know, it kind of went back and forth. So society became, you know, kind of inundated with information. So they don't want to do any more looking. They don't want to pick up a paper, read something, and then get on, you know, the internet or make a phone call to see if that information is true or correct, or, if this information is missing anything. So they're just taking the media's like word for it, just going, okay, that's good enough for me. Forgetting the fact, of course, that there was things that were omitted. There was general terms being used, you know, that obviously would make us all law enforcement officers look like this is what we do, instead of like, no, this is just what this one officer did on this one day during this one traffic stop with this one subject. You know, it wasn't like across the board. The media also has the ability to say, put information out there. One of the things that I heard often, so in the Bay Area, when I would do traffic stops, you know, and I did some 3,300 traffic stops a year. I would hear it quite often, you know, like, well, you pulled me over because I'm, you know, fill in the blank. And I worked swing shifts and mids most of the time. So, you know, in a city with that many lights and cars going by, especially if it was occurring on a highway or one of the major roads, like I typically wasn't on the side of the road someplace monitoring. I was in traffic already and the vehicles were typically ahead of me. And so then I would see something, you know, like an unsafe turn or, you know, maybe they would, you know, following too closely to somebody or whatever, what have you, pull them over. You know, I have no idea who's in the vehicle, no clue. Like a lot of states, you know, people drive around with, you know, tinted windows, whether or not they're legal, you know, it's just a common practice at this point. You know, most people have tinted windows. Even if you didn't have tinted windows, most windows of vehicles are tinted in the back, you know, the back window and the two rear passenger windows, making it almost, or at least virtually impossible to see who's in the driver's seat. And most of the time, I would say, you know, I can't say every time, because there were times that I did get a chance to see the driver because we were passing each other. But most of the time, I had no idea who was sitting in that driver's seat. You know, so no way, you know, I could not have racially profiled the person. I couldn't have sexually profiled the person. You know, all I know is there's a vehicle. There was obviously got to be a driver in there because, you know, the vehicle's on the road. And up until a certain point, it was actually maybe being operated legally or lawfully. And then now I pulled it over. So I couldn't have possibly have known. And, you know, the media doesn't make it seem like that. You know, they could put that out there. Like, law enforcement officers cannot see through your windows. You know, we cannot alter physics and make the sun not reflect off glass, you know, so we are too far away. You know, we're human, you know, so some of us need glasses. Some of us are wearing glasses, but we need better glasses. We're looking at you. Yeah. But I mean, we're still talking about, you know, a lot of the times the vehicle's already moving, there's sun in the way, you know, maybe it's dark, you know, we have no idea who's sitting in the driver's seat. The media could easily, you know, put that out there, you know, some sort of informational piece, or, you know, they could even do that as a reminder in the back of the paper, you know, as a footnote or something, but they don't. And unfortunately, that leads to this misconception, you know, when you have these scathing reports about, you know, profiling or sexually profiling, or, you know, even just picking not on a race or a sex, but like just picking on certain vehicles, like, you know, we're picking on all race cars out there or muscle cars. but they omit a lot of information, and that goes a long way to hurt, you know, hurting law enforcement and the community, you know, because even if that officer is desperately trying to build or heal that relationship, you know, the media just seems to come right behind it, just kind of cuts it. So now the officer is starting back at square one every single day. And it's a lot. And if we try to put out, like, say, a paper, and by we, I mean law enforcement, you know, only those that are pro law enforcement are really going to read it. And then those that are absolutely against law enforcement may skim it, you know, to see if there's something in there they want to argue, but, you know, they're not really going to read it. So I wish the media was a little bit more pro information, not pro law enforcement, just pro information than they are. But, you know, they've got a business to sell. So, and since we can't control it, it's going to be up to us and law enforcement to overcome that problem. We have to address that problem.
What does defund the police mean to you?
I think that's I don't think it's what it means to me, but what it means to, you know, whoever it is that's saying defund the police. And so when I would research it, because that movement really kind of came up toward the, well, after I graduated from law school, And so my specialty is constitutional law, and specifically really anything to do with like law enforcement. But I've also had a recent love for the First Amendment. But then, when this whole movement came out in terms of like defunding law enforcement, I was really kind of focused on just the constitutional law portion. And when they talk about like say defunding, it meant something different to just about everybody. And it was difficult to try to pin it down in terms of like what that meant to say certain communities. So I had to focus on the one community that seemed to be prevalent in the media, which was out there in Minneapolis. So for them, it meant like they actually wanted to abolish police officers. It wasn't defund, it was abolish. And because that's the definition they provided, they wanted to get rid of law enforcement. They had this idea that what we actually needed was a somebody to serve the community in terms of being a social worker. They had these ideas, and many of these ideas, you have to understand, have already been in place in many large agencies. Like it started out as a thing called, community policing, but it quickly just became policing. And it was difficult to read, what these guys were asking for, because it was like, okay, well, that's what law enforcement officers are already trained to do. And so when I researched Minneapolis police, they did receive a lot of training in community policing and crisis intervention training. And so everything they were asking for was already there. But what they wanted to do was just abolish the police with this strange belief that, we can just govern ourselves. Now, I say strange because that's not a new belief. That's been around for as long as there's ever been a community, and it's always failed. It has never been successful. People are people, and unfortunately, there are just some people that just love nothing more than to prey on other people, and it's just I think that's just the nature of humankind. And in this case, there's almost always been somebody there to say enforce the policies or rules or laws, and to make sure that most of us are going to abide those policies and laws anyway. But to make sure that those persons who are not going to, can't harm people or harm as few people as possible. So what they were asking for in Minneapolis was an abolishment. And then what they were asking for, say, in Seattle was they were essentially asking just for a new type of police officer. What they didn't want was a thug. And how they got to thug is very confusing to me. I've worked with Seattle police before. I know a few Seattle police officers, and like it did, thug and Seattle police, those two things just didn't come together for me. So they were basing it on a lot of like just what their, prejudices of law enforcement. And so what they were looking for was what already existed, and they wanted to see the funds used to say, for more community events and things like that, which is exactly what the police officers had already been calling for. But those funds didn't exist, and the amount of calls for service in Seattle were just, they're big. It's a very busy place for them, so they don't have the manpower to commit to many of these things. And then when you talked about here on the East Coast, and you went to Newark, New Jersey, and when they were talking about defund the police, what they meant here was, they wanted what I guess what we were already enjoying, say, in California, in terms of like, some of the best agencies I've worked with are, in the Bay Area, and like Palo Alto PD, Menlo Park PD, Santa Clara, especially Santa Clara PD, and Gilroy, Hollister, those agencies that have like joint, law enforcement connections. These guys were already doing what Newark wanted to do, and see, that's where I had to do some more investigation, and I already knew this, but it was new to some of the students I was teaching, or some of the students at the time I was tutoring, that we have different policies and different types of law enforcement going on all throughout the United States. Like there's just it just varies from town to town, county to county, city to city, state to state, coast to coast. And so I don't know what they had before in New York, Newark, New Jersey for law enforcement. But whatever it wasn't a community police officer. It wasn't what, you know, in California they were already enjoying, say, in Palo Alto or Santa Clara, where the ultimate goal for law enforcement there was to, you know, be part of the community, you know, to be not, you know, a standoff position in the community, but to be intricately combined or intertwined with their community. So that's what defund the police meant over there. So they ended up like, I guess they ended up like firing a few of the key police officers or the administration staff, and then they rehired or hired law enforcement officers with that community policing training. They did a bunch of training. And so what they ended up with was like a model, like Santa Clara PD model for New York. So it's difficult to say like what that means, you know, defund the police, because it seemed to have like a very specific definition, but then when you actually applied it and, you know, spread it across the United States, it took on a life of its own and became so vague and overbroad that it was so difficult to define. So, but when you ask just my opinion on it, like what it means to defund law enforcement, it means just that. It's that definition. You're going to take away the money and the resources from the police officers. To me, that does not say I'm going to remove the police officers. I'm not going to reduce the law enforcement officers. I'm not going to make any changes to the police. I'm just going to take away their money. And which is a ridiculous concept to me, because I already know that most of these agencies are either right at their budget or like they've already, you know, like they blow their budget well before like the, you know, the second quarter, you know, because they just need, they need equipment, you know. And some agencies can't even field, like, say, you know, they can give you know, your vest. They'll supply a set of uniform. They may supply your gun belt, maybe the holster that, you know, of your choice, but you're going to have to provide your own weapon and ammo and your own handcuffs. And, you know, they may even provide a radio, or you sometimes you have to buy your own radio. I know for a fact that many agencies, a gross number of agencies across the US, you know, a lot of the officers have to purchase anything outside of like a single uniform issue. And it's up to them if they want something different, if they want something better, you know, they're going to have to buy that product for themselves. So much of your income as a police officer is actually spent on buying your own equipment. And some of that equipment does include, in fact, things that go into or onto the vehicle. And that, of course, depends on the size of the agency. That's going to depend on the agency's budget and the location of the agency. And so for like the Bureau of Indian Affairs police officers, they receive quite a bit of equipment. You know, they're, I think in my opinion, very well taken care of in terms of like what they are issued. I think the BIA does a fantastic job at training their law enforcement officers and providing them equipment. And those guys certainly have like just massive areas to patrol under some like really strenuous circumstances and situations. And, you know, defunding them, you know, if that's what we were going to try to do and take away that money, I mean, ultimately then at that point we'd be taking away their safety equipment, because that's what they're issued. None of this stuff goes toward like just being nice. Like, you know, I'm not rocking a, you know, a Beats, you know, portable speaker system in my car because the city paid for it. You know, this is my third pair of boots, you know, in 5 years, and I wear them all the way down to they're smooth on the bottom before I can get another pair. So when you're asking me to defund, you're asking me, you're going to take away my boots. So I already don't make enough money. You know, I don't know why people think police officers make a lot of money. They don't. On average, you know, most officers across the US make about $40,000 a year. And that's not a lot, especially currently now with inflation. Rent prices were going through the roof and all sorts of areas that, you know, you would never think you'd be paying, you know, Bay Area prices for. And, you know, the officer's pay typically isn't adjusted for inflation. You know, it's pretty fixed. Now I can't say that for every agency, but I can say that confidently for most of the agencies. So to me, defunding means you want to take away the safety equipment of the police officers. You're taking away the things, the tools and things that they need that actually is used in their course of their duty, that's called for, you know, that's already been proven not only to save their life, but the lives of other people. And you're taking away their training. Many agencies already don't get enough training. You know, if it were up to me, every officer across the United States would have to complete at least 20 hours of training a month in critical areas. And then every officer across the United States would have to at least qualify on the range at least once a month, you know, but the, or at least go to the range once a month and qualify every 3 months. But that would, that's an impossibility. There's like many agencies can't afford that. So defund to me was, it was a ridiculous concept, and it could only end one way, which is police officers leaving because they can't afford to be police officers.
What would you say to those, for example, in Newark, New Jersey, that want to defund the police? What would you tell them in terms of why law enforcement should not be defunded?
It would really be like just helping them to understand what it is they're asking for. So they're not asking for a defund, you know, what they're asking for is better training. So we don't want to defund, we want to increase, we want to fund. You know, we want to try to get like as you know these officers to as much training as we possibly can. You know, we want to try to get them the best equipment, you know, we possibly can. What we don't want to do is, you know, leave these guys hanging, as it were, you know, with zero support. So, and the best way, you know, to deal with, you know, like Newark is, I think, typical of a lot of New Jersey cities. You know, the people are pretty passionate about, you know, their communities. They're passionate about their histories. So you would have to meet with the, you know, the community leaders to make sure that, you know, first they understand, and then, you know, meet with the communities as well to let them know what it is that they're actually asking for. So we have to change the language. We got to change the definition. And now, if that's not successful, that's not the end of it. If they want to use the word defund to say what they're saying, okay, so be it. But that's just the way Newark's going to define it, not the way we're going to define it across the US. But from there, you know, we would make sure that, you know, they were involved in say what it is their officers are receiving training in. And from there, you know, we can also like address like why say, you know, that training isn't important, or maybe that training isn't very functional for law enforcement officers. Or we'd have to also address as a community and a law enforcement agency how training actually happens. You know, we can't just expect an officer who's done 12 to 18 hours on a shift overnight to now go to an 8 hour training session and then come back tonight, you know, for another 12 to 18 hours. You know, and it's not going to happen. But we also can't take that officer off the street because, you know, we need them in that beat. So it would really be a matter, it'd be a slow process of making sure they understand what it is they're asking for, and then helping, you know, together building a model of what that would look like, and then, you know, implementing, you know, the reasonableness, you know, the aspects, the reasonable aspects of that model into the law enforcement agency while keeping the community, you know, informed about what it is that they are doing, the law enforcement officers are actually doing for the community. But the idea, you know, that you know, to defund them, to not, you know, to abolish is what they're actually asking for, is obviously a bad idea. We've got a lot of examples across the world in which, you know, law enforcement has been abolished, and you know, it's not a community anymore. We call those war zones, and you know, or abandoned altogether. And I think many of the people who live in Newark would probably agree with that, you know, because Newark is already, you know, well, was one of the highest crime areas, one of the most violent areas, and it kind of comes and goes in terms of like where it rates in terms of violence and say organized crime violence as well. But I think they would understand or have a better understanding than say, you know, some small town in Oklahoma, you know, in terms of like what it would look like if they didn't have their police. So we would work on education, you know, in terms of like what the city actually means when they're saying, you know, defund, what they say when they mean abolish. And then we would work on, you know, because all they did was literally they wanted an abolishment. Apparently to them that meant get rid of the administrative staff that's been there for like 30, 40 years, who had a old era mindset of law enforcement, and then replace them with somebody who had community policing experience. So that to them, that's what that meant. But the I think if anybody would understand what would happen if you took your police officers out of play, I think Newark would definitely be able to share that experience with people across the US.
In the future, how would you like the image of law enforcement to be altered?
I think in much the same way, maybe not altered, it's more like a combination of what we had before, we're talking about the small town officer, you talk about the quote unquote Wild West, right? So you got the sheriff and the sheriff's office there in the small town, and he's got the one office on one end with the horses tied up. The typically the sheriff or the marshal or they didn't call them police officers at that time, with that was their also their home. So they slept above the jail or behind it, and everybody kind of knew where they were. Everybody knew who this person was. And while that, I mean, that's great for a tiny town, it's not really going to work for a large city. We're not going to, build an entire community of apartments above a police agency. But what I would like to see is something along those lines. But the mindset, and I still see it in agencies, not with every officer, but I'd still see it where they've got this mindset of it's us versus them. And them being the community, us being, whoever that team of law enforcement is. And that mindset needs to be, if anything needs to be abolished, that's the mindset that needs to be abolished. It is not us versus them, it's us. That symbol on my badge, the words on my badge, those are my dedication. Those are my promise to that specific community, to serve this community, to protect this community. And you don't do law enforcement because you hate it, or at least you didn't start out that way. You did it because you loved your community. And that's what needs to be fostered. And I don't really care if somebody thinks that sounds cheesy or not, but if you're going to be an effective law enforcement officer, you need to love your community. And you need to love your community more than you love your job as well. So when you find yourself starting to get kind of salty and mean and crass and snappy at people, or you start to violate their constitutional rights, because your pride took control of your ego is now starting to demand things, then you need to know that it's time to step out and let somebody else into that position, before you damage that reputation, the law enforcement reputation for the rest of us. And before you damage something also between that law enforcement agency and that community that you promised to serve. So the mindset that I would be looking for is one that sees themselves as a member of the community, not apart from the community, not a support piece, but an intertwined member of the community in which they serve. They don't have to live there, but they've got to be a part of it. And it doesn't matter what community, high crime, drug infested, gang infested, to high end, it's you've got to be a part of that community. And the mindset from there would be one of tirelessness, like, because it's not something like every good relationship, it's not something you just start and just leave, it's something that needs to be fostered. So you're going to need that officer or those officers to encourage one another and have an agency that encourages them, to continue that progress, between the law enforcement agency and the community itself. So I think that's where I would see it going in the future. And I think that's what would make law enforcement officers, I think, more successful.
And ultimately, before we end, how do we trust the badge?
We have to see them as people. We've got to see them as people. Not these faceless superhumans. And it's difficult to do because, we designed the uniform and the police vehicles to look very similar for a reason, a very distinct reason. One, they stand out. So that's a police officer. Two, so you can't tell how many officers are on duty. That obviously backfires in small towns. You know exactly who's on duty. But in larger towns, you have no idea. If there's like a saturation of black and whites and police officers in uniform, you almost never look at the face. And if you do look at the face, we all kind of look alike, and it's difficult to tell like who's on duty, who's not on duty. But if we're going to trust the badge, you know, then we're going to need to see them as humans, and not only humans, but humans that are fallible. You know, they're not perfect. And any law enforcement officer out there that it's like wakes up in the morning and thinks that they're God's gift to law enforcement, you know, is sadly mistaken. You are definitely not. You are not a master of this craft. Nobody is. We're constantly working at it. You know, if you've got an ego, if you've got a little too much pride in yourself, you know, and you think you got if somebody were to ask you a question, you got an answer for it, then you know you're wrong. You're incorrect. You already lost this conversation. So we need to see them as human. We need to see them as fallible. We need to see them as like us. They're students, you know, they're students of the law, they're students of life. We need to see them as people who are trying, you know, as well. We need to see them as people who have answered a calling to do something that most of the community is not prepared to deal with. It's not that they're afraid, it's not that they're less brave or something. It's just, you know, in some aspects, they're just not prepared to deal with what the law enforcement officer has to deal with. And that's okay. You know, not everybody is going to want to go running into a gunfight. Not everybody's going to go running into a bar where people are slugging it out and you know you're going to get into a fight. Not everybody wants to work, you know, 18 hours a day in the same uniform, you know, sweating through your vest. So we have these people who get up, you know, at the beginning of their shift, and for not great money, under dangerous circumstances, and I don't care who says it's not dangerous. That's a ridiculous assessment. It is dangerous, you know. And don't, you know, the argument of, you know, dangerous per capita or whatever as it compares to say something else is also ridiculous. You can't compare it to something else. It's not like anything else. There is no other position out there in service and in community service, which is proactive, like a law enforcement officer is. You don't see firefighters running around like checking homes, you know, and opening up and ch seeing how people cook dinner that night to make sure it doesn't start a grease fire. You don't see EMS going into the homes and conducting like random, you know, health checks, you know, but you see law enforcement officers out there, you know, every day conducting traffic stops or, you know, consensual encounters or pedestrian stops or bicycle stops or, you know, business welfare checks, you know, welfare checks on homes. You know, this is proactive action that is unique to law enforcement. So if we're going to trust the badge, we have to understand that they're human, they're fallible, that they're students of the law like any other person is, really. And then, you know, we have to see them as somebody who's answered a unique calling, and they've done so because they really do love the community. And they're, you know, they're not doing it for fame. They're certainly not doing it for the riches. They're not doing it nowadays, especially for nowadays. They're not doing it for some sort of like popularity, you know, because if you want to shut down a party, you know, any especially anywhere around a college campus, you know, tell them that you're a police officer. And I mean, it's I get you know, back in the day, it used to be a joke that, you know, I tell people I'm a lawyer, and you know, there's like a million lawyer jokes out there. It talks about us, you know, selling the devil's soul. But now law enforcement is like at the bottom of the barrel, you know, but these guys still proudly proclaim it. And if we're going to trust the badge, you know, we need to see them, you know, as humans, as fallible, as people who have answered a calling and people who continue to answer a calling. And then we as the community, I know it's up to the officer in terms of like how they're going to train and how they're going to teach their community, but I would like to put some onus on the community itself to say, you know, if you're curious about it, you know, just don't take the media's like viewpoint on law enforcement or, you know, like as truth for your agency, for your officers. You know, that police are conducting, you know, community events throughout the US. You know, you've seen them before, like, you know, have donuts with a cop or coffee with a cop, or, you know, it's some agencies do that tipping thing, you know, where they'll be waiters and waitresses for the evening, and all the tips go toward a certain event. You know, take part in it. Get to know your local agency. You know, be proactive as a community. That's how we learn to trust the badge.
Before we finish up, would you like to add anything?
Primarily, like I just want to encourage, like if you know, if there's law enforcement officers out there, people who are, you know, going to join law enforcement, is, you know, you continue your education. And it's always changing. it's evolving all the time. Like I can't maintain my status as an expert in constitutional law if I just were to put it in neutral. I got a doctorate in law. I've got a master. I've got my BA. I've got 20 years of law enforcement experience as a sergeant and then a captain. But that's not going to cut it. You got to keep pressing that education button. And if you're going to put any concentration in any area, obviously that's going to be the Fourth Amendment. So it's continuously changing. I think SCOTUS has a new opinion on it. It feels like every other day. That's an obvious exaggerate. Is that I'm obviously exaggerating. It's typically like once every couple of months or something, or maybe once even every 6 months, but it seems to happen all the time and you need to be on top of it. So if you're going to be in law enforcement or you're in law enforcement, then I would really encourage you to take courses in constitutional law, specifically in the Fourth Amendment. If you're working right now as a police officer, then I'm encouraging you to get with your DA, get with somebody in the DA's office, and I don't care what it takes, convince them, take them out to lunch. Lawyers love lunch. You buy me a cheeseburger and I'll sit all day in your class and teach. So if you ask your DA's office to send somebody over to help educate, you want to concentrate on the Fourth Amendment, you want to talk about any kind of updates, and you want to know how to apply it. How do I make this as a police officer applicable? If you're looking into law enforcement, the same thing. As a police officer, how am I going to make this applicable? And you need to be looking at the news every day. You need to be reviewing what's occurred across the U.S. Police One does a great job at gathering up information, and presenting it in a pretty good way. They got good editors. They got good writers. That is information for you to digest. That is information that can help you along, not only if you're looking to be in law enforcement or if you're already in law enforcement. So that if I'm going to leave anything on the table before we end this podcast, that's education, 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 and then one more time, education.
Thank you for listening to this episode. And if you haven't already, please make sure you are following this podcast and please make sure that you are following the Instagram page at Trust the Badge.